Before I start preaching, I notice that Chris is not here, which means she's really been tied up with some grandchildren. She wasn't sure whether she'd make it or not, which means I would like to catch a lift from somebody after the service. So, thank you, Tony. That was quick. I call Isaiah a man overwhelmed by the holiness of God. But let me begin by saying, look, I'm getting tired and frustrated every time that I hear the latest version of anti-Christian arguments that patronisingly tell us, look, before this modern era, it was possible to believe in God, but in these enlightened times, we can see that it was all based on a myth. A very comforting myth, but a myth nevertheless. And so they invite me to come and join them in the 21st century. Well, I want to tell these critics that it would be hard to find anything more ancient than most of the stuff they dish up to me. Did you catch the drama in that reading that we had? It was a time of great crisis. A great crisis in Judah. And the Assyrians have surrounded the city. Just to get a sense of what that meant for them, one might recall two or three points. The first was that Jerusalem, because it was the home of God, was absolutely invincible. Let's just read. I'm not reading from Isaiah. The same flavour goes right throughout the book, but Psalm 46, which most of us would know on some occasions, because it has that beautiful verse, "Be still and know that I am God." But the context of that I thought they'd taken 46 out. God is our refuge. Therefore we won't fear, even though the earth give way. There is the holy place where the Most High dwells. God is within her. She will not fall. God will help her at break of day. The Lord Almighty is with us. Or you could go to Psalm 132, where you'll find something quite similar. Where is it? Psalm 132. For the Lord has chosen Zion, or Jerusalem. He has desired it for his dwelling. This is my resting place forever and ever. Here I will sit enthroned because I have desired it. Jerusalem was absolutely invincible. And the affirmation of that coloured their church, practically every church service that they held. In other words, it was something over and over again. So here is a crisis. The Assyrians are surrounding the city. Assyria. I've said before that Assyria was the atom bomb of that generation. Nothing like Assyria had ever been seen on the world stage before. It was a destructive, cruel, ruthless, and invincible power. A power that was now intent on extending its borders in the west, that is, Israel, Judah, Egypt, and so on. Assyria. Nobody can resist Assyria. And the man with his finger on that atom bomb was this brilliant man known as the Rabshakeh. We read about it. It was a pretty dramatic reading. But just notice the first thing he says that he attacks. He says, "You stupid people, you are relying on Egypt." Well, they're all washed up. They're not going to help you. But then he turns to God. I mean, he doesn't turn to God, he turns again. Yeah. Right, yeah. So he offers them. So he turns his attack upon God. But more than that, he offers them a kind of salvation. Look, the way that the book of Deuteronomy, for instance, talks about salvation. Let's read it. In Deuteronomy chapter 8. It talks about, "I will bring you into a great land." The Lord your God is bringing you into a good land. A land with streams and pools of water, with springs flowing in the valleys. A land with wheat and barley vines, and fig trees and pomegranates, olive oil and honey. A land where bread will not be scarce, and you will lack nothing. A land where the rocks are iron and you can dig copper out of the hills. Wow. That's almost identical with what the Assyrians were offering to Jerusalem, to the Jews. If you want salvation, you trust us. We'll give it to you. Not this God business. We'll give it to you. We'll give you the fruitful life. We will enable you to sit down under your own fig tree and eat the fruit of your own vine. Here, Here is where you will find fulfillment. I don't know. But somehow, maybe it's just me, but somehow I find it very comforting that years ago, the seductive alternatives to a life of faith have a familiar ring about them. The wise ones had discovered then that religion could now be written off as an exploded myth. For Isaiah, I could almost hear him explode whenever anyone locates him in the world of myth or the world of mythic theology. And one reason for that is it was not myth that sent him out as a prophet of Yahweh, nor a myth that sustained him during a heartbreaking mission. Listen to his call. Isaiah chapter 6, I'm reading from. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord seated on a throne, high and exalted, and the train of his robe filled the temple. Above him were seraphs, each with six wings. With two wings they covered their faces, with two they covered their feet, and with two they were flying. And they were calling to one another, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord Almighty. The whole earth is full of his glory." Then I heard a voice, "Whom shall I send? And who will go for us?" And I said, "Here am I, send him." Oh, I think that's too often the answer. "Here am I, send me." It was not myth that sustained Isaiah in an impossible mission. It was a mission that almost broke, well, in fact, I think did break his heart. Let me give you two indications of that. In chapter 22, I think it's verse 4, it talks about him weeping. "Let me weep bitterly. Do not try to console me over the destruction of my people." He wept as the pain of his mission began to fail. Oh, no, not the pain began to fail. The mission failed. But more than that, did you catch the fact that in the commission, God said to him, "I want you to go, but I want to tell you straight out, you're going to fail." That's pretty positive stuff, isn't it? Listen. He said, go and tell this people, and they will be ever hearing, but never understanding, ever seeing, but never perceiving. And then I said, Lord, for how long? And he answered, until the cities lie ruined and without inhabitant, until the houses are left deserted. Isaiah wept as he saw his mission coming true in that sense. His sense of the awesome holiness of God penetrated his heart from the day of that vision in the temple. And I would suggest that anyone who says they understand what happened in the temple, they probably missed the point. This was not a vision to understand. I think it's probably more appropriate to allow these words, holy, holy, holy is the Lord God, to penetrate our heart. And to help us do that, I'm going to resort, I think I've told this before, but I'm going to resort to a way that the learned biblical scholars would either smile condescendingly on or just laugh out of court. Charles Simeon, one of the founders really of the Evangelical Union, or precursors, Charles Simeon said, our minds are so clouded by earthly things that we don't understand the significance of the six wings. You know, six wings, obviously, they're there for them to fly with. Oh no, he said. Even though these seraphs live in the presence of God, they cover their eyes with two of their wings because they are not worthy to look upon him. They cover their feet because they are not worthy to go in his service. And of course, for the other two, they fly. I'd encourage you to let that sink into your heart, that sense of the Holy One of God. Maybe I should have said what I'm going to say now. Maybe I should have said that at the beginning. This is the beginning, but I'm not sure how helpful it will be to learn a very few things that we know about this man. He was almost certainly from the upper echelons of the society of that day. And there is a small tradition that he was the brother of the king Hezekiah, but certainly he was able to go into the temple as he wanted and so on. He was married. His wife was a prophet. That's interesting. Mrs. Isaiah. And I wondered, I wonder if how many of these prophecies come from Mrs. Isaiah. What did he preach? Well, Rochelle has given us a summary. Challenge, judgment, redemption. It is not without significance that a man who was so overwhelmed by holiness that he was revolted by their debased worship. But if you ask what was wrong with their worship, you will learn that it wasn't over whether they should have trumpets or harps, Hillsong or Paul Joya. It was what they did outside the service that made their worship a perversion. What they did outside made their worship a perversion. Listen. Chapter 1. They have forsaken the Lord. They have spurned the Holy One of Israel. So, the multitude of your sacrifices, what are they to me? I've had more than enough of your burnt offerings. I take no pleasure in the blood of bulls and goats. As for your new moon festivals and your appointed feasts, they have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing. I will hide my eyes from you, even if you offer many prayers. What they were doing outside was what made their worship inside unacceptable to God. That's a terrible thing. Your festivals have become a burden to me. I am weary of bearing it. I think every church ought to take seriously, oh God, is it possible that our services weary you? Is it possible that I weary you? We could spend a long time on the various sins that Isaiah attacks. But underlying most of it was a passionate call for justice. And it is here that he is too easy in one sense to understand. But to understand him, I think we need to look at that first verse. No, the second verse. You see, Isaiah wasn't so much as a man with a moral conscience. Let me say that again. It wasn't that he was a man with a moral conscience who was also religious. He begins his prophecy by saying this: the ox knows its owner, and the donkey knows his master's crib, but my people don't know. Even the donkeys have the right relationship, but my people don't know.
have any relationship to me anymore. And it is out of that relationship that he burned with a passion for justice. It is then that he prophesies. It is then that he preaches. And it seemed to me that any person who can read those, particularly chapter 1 and chapter 5, any person who can read that and come away unscathed, probably should be troubled. But we have heard a little of his talk of judgment. But it wasn't only judgment. It wasn't only judgment. There was redemption. Redemption because of something that I forgot when I was a little earlier. The Holy One. The Holy One. And you read that first in that first chapter, and you read how sick, from the top of your head to the sole of your feet, you are sick with sin and even murder. And God says, I am not just the Holy One. I am the Holy One of Israel. The Holy One who takes this corrupt people and identify myself with them. And out of that identification, there is the vision of redemption. And notice I've said the vision. Isaiah calls his whole thing in chapter 1, the vision concerning Judah and so on. The vision. What does that tell me? You know, I don't expect visions to be necessarily fulfilled. One of the great pains that I have known was to have a vision for the church that I never saw anywhere near fulfilled. I think that's what Isaiah had. But, listen, this is what he saw concerning Judah and Jerusalem. Chapter 2. In the last days, the mountain of the Lord's temple will be established as chief among the mountains. It will be raised above the hills, and all nations will stream to it. Many peoples will come and say, come, let us go up to the mountain of the Lord, to the house of the God of Jacob, and he will teach us his ways. And it finishes, come, O house of Judah, let us walk in the light of the Lord. Well, they didn't. And the vision was not fulfilled. Let me finish
asked, have I spoken about a book with 39 chapters? You know, I'm the man who uses a microscope, not a telescope. And here's 39 chapters in one sermon. Wow. But let me finish by saying this. Isaiah moved in the upper strata of society. And because of that, his ministry was to the movers and shakers of the world. So when I come down from Isaiah to me, what is there for me? I spend most of my life now unable to drive. Well, I'm unable to drive any of the time. And I spend most of my life inside my office. You could call it a pretty restricted life. You could call it that. But I certainly am not in a place where I can be of much influence. So I ask God, as I hope you will, what does it mean for a person like me to be a holy person? For me, more and more, that's becoming something that affects my marriage. In the therapeutic model that I used, or models that I used, there wasn't much room for such things as self-sacrifice. I think holiness can involve sacrifice. I'd love to be able to say to you, I mean, hang it all, I'm 80, I've been a Christian now for 55 years, I should know what it means for an ordinary person to be holy. Well, I'm sorry. I'm still trying to know. But that's the prayer of my heart. God, in my situation, let me be a holy person. God bless you. Thank you.